As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
This afternoon, I'm going to be speaking about happiness understood psychologically. But I want to start off with a story that actually begins right here. Well, not actually right here, but right across the street, the Catholic University of America. So this was about 15 years ago, and I got this amazing dream job at Catholic U. I was hired to be the director of the University Honors Program. And it was fantastic. I got a huge raise. I got about a 40% raise over what I was making. And we got into this fantastic parish called St. John the Beloved, which is in McLean, Virginia. And it was the best parish I've ever been in. Wonderful people. I made lots of friends. And it was just great. But there was one huge problem. My wife hated Washington, D.C. Hated it. And so basically, we had this huge conflict. And we're fighting about where to live. I wanted to live in Washington, D.C. She wanted to return to Los Angeles. And so we were fighting. And basically, I was not making any headway at all. So I thought, okay, I've got to invoke divine aid. So I started to pray, and I started to offer Lenten sacrifices that my wife would love it in D.C. No change. Okay. So then I thought, I've got to get my friends to pray. I got my friends to pray. My wife would love it in D.C. Still no change. So because things were not going very well, I went to my wife one day and I said, you know, honey, I've been praying that you would love it here in D.C. And she said, well, that's very interesting. Have you asked God what God wants? No, I hadn't done that. So I didn't want to ask God what God wanted, because I thought, what if God wants me to go back to Los Angeles? So after maybe 2 weeks, I thought, well, I should probably consult God, because he's, you know, knows everything, and he's all good, and, you know, probably should check in. And so eventually, I got up the courage to ask God what God wanted, and I felt convinced quite quickly that God wanted me to return to Los Angeles. So that's what I did. And I'd like to tell you that I got back to Los Angeles, and when I got back there, I had a big smile on my face, and everything was great, but that would be a lie. I got back to Los Angeles, and I was very unhappy, and I missed my friends from Washington, D.C., and I missed my job from Washington, D.C., and I was totally bummed out, and I was totally sad. And so I did what any scholar like myself would do. I went to Google, and I typed in how to be happier. Very scholarly, intense scholarly research. And up popped something I'd never heard of before. There's something called positive psychology. Have any of you guys heard of that term? Okay, a lot of people have. Good. So if you haven't, positive psychology is a relatively recent movement in psychology. It started in about the year 2000 when Martin Seligman from the University of Pennsylvania was president of the American Psychological Association. And at their annual meeting, Professor Seligman said, hey, fellow psychologists, it's great that for years we've been focusing on things like anxiety, things like depression, things like trauma, and that's really important. But we should also focus on the other end of the human experience, right? Focus also on things like resiliency, things like signature strengths, and things like optimism. And so he challenged his fellow psychologists to focus also on these other things. So they did. And so what positive psychology did was do empirical studies on various interventions to try to figure out what really helped people to be more positive, more optimistic, more resilient, etc. And so they did all these clinical studies. They studied these interventions the way you'd study medication. So if you're studying medication like for asthma, they'd have people that are suffering from, you know, asthmatic symptoms, and half the group, they'd say, we want you to take this medication, you know, see what happens. And the other half of the group would be given a placebo. So they take some medication that's just a sugar tablet or something. And then they measure in a double-blind study which interventions really helped the asthma and which interventions didn't help at all. So they did this with various interventions to boost happiness. So for instance, Martin Seligman himself in one of his studies said to some students in this class, I want you to do some altruistic activity. Go to a nursing home, make friends with the elderly people there, try to help them be less lonely. You know, go to a school, help kids learn how to read. You know, help people in some way. The other group, they said, we want you to do some fun activities. So go to the movies with your friends, go get some ice cream, do something fun. Measure the outcome. And basically what happened was both groups reported a significant increase in positive emotion. But the group that had the ice cream and going to the movies basically said, yeah, I was really happy, that's great. But then it basically went away really quickly. But the group that did the altruistic activities, they reported, you know, that really boosted my happiness and it really lasted a long time. So they had a greater increase in positive emotion. So what Seligman did is think about, well, what really does boost happiness? And you might ask yourself, well, what is happiness exactly? We talked in the last class about the levels of happiness, but now I want to talk to you about positive psychology, or at least Seligman's idea of what happiness is. And you can remember this by an acronym. The acronym is PERMA. What does PERMA stand for? The P in PERMA stands for positive emotion. That, according to Seligman, is part of happiness, but not the whole of happiness. Positive emotion, feeling upbeat, feeling optimistic, etc. The E stands for engagement. This is also sometimes called flow. The idea of engagement or flow, and you've experienced this, I'm sure, in your own lives, is when you're doing some activity and time seems to just stop, right? So maybe it's playing a video game, maybe it's playing basketball, it might be talking with friends. But the basic idea is you'll be doing your activity, whatever it is, and maybe an hour goes by, but you feel as if it's like 10 minutes because you're so engaged, you're so focused, you're so in sense of flow. The R in PERMA stands for relationships. And according to the positive psychology research, this is the key non-negotiable aspect of having a happy life, having a good, flourishing life, positive relationships. The most famous study on this topic was called the Grant Study. It was done at Harvard University, and it began with students in college. So they began with people 19, 20, 21 years old, and studied them over the decades. So the study ended when the last people died in their 90s. And basically, it looked at what made a good life. And they found a couple really important things. First, what makes a bad life? Excessive use of alcohol. Everybody who abused alcohol died young, had a horrible life, things went totally off the rails. But what helped them have a positive life? The key thing they said was good relationships, loving relationships. Whether those are relationships as husband and wife or relationships with friends and family, the key thing was good relationships. In fact, the lead researcher said that happiness is love, full stop. Happiness is love, full stop. The next part of PERMA is meaning. What does meaning mean? The idea of meaning is making a contribution to something bigger than yourself. So it could be something on a very grand scale, right? You're Abraham Lincoln, and you keep the Union together during the Civil War, right? You're Winston Churchill, and you fight off the Nazis so that your country doesn't fall to Hitler. But meaning can also be on a small scale, right? You're a good father making a difference for his children. You're a good mother making a difference for her children. You're a good priest making a difference for the people you minister to. So that can be in the newspaper, but you are, in fact, making a positive difference for those people that you can make a positive difference for, right? Meaning. And you note how meaning and positive emotion may or may not go together. So you think about Lincoln and Churchill, they were both known for their bouts with depression. And if you're depressed, you obviously don't have a lot of positive emotion, right? So you can be high in terms of meaning, have good meaning in your life, and yet low in positive emotion, but also vice versa. So these are distinct aspects of happiness according to Seligman. And the final part is the A The A is achievement. Achievement has to do with getting your goals, reaching your goals, striving towards your goals. So think about, you may have a to-do list on some days, and you say, okay, I got up, made my bed, went to class, you know, worked out with weights, whatever it is on your to-do list. And if you ever go through your day and you're like, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, you feel at the end of the day, yeah, I really achieved something. And achievement can be intrinsic or extrinsic. Intrinsic achievement has to do with doing the activity. Extrinsic achievement is like, I made $20, right? So both kinds of achievement are things that people appreciate and people like. So what is a good life? What is a happy life according to Martin Seligman? It's karma, right? Positive emotion, engagement, relationship, meaning, and achievement. Now, in reading the positive psychology literature, I already told you about one of the findings, which was that people that were altruistic and did altruistic service for others had higher levels of positive emotion than people that just went to get ice cream and watch movies. But here's another one of the findings. Another one of the key findings of positive psychology is the absolute centrality of gratitude for a good life. They did one study where they had people that were moderately depressed, and they asked them, they said, hey, every day, at the end of your day, what I want you to do is think about your day and think about any three things in your day that you're grateful for. So it could be something like, well, we had a nice lunch today, right? Tasty, you choose your sandwich, get your chips, tasted good. Had a nice conversation with a friend, talked about significant issues. And hopefully when that podcast appears, it'll be something that'll be worthwhile for others to listen to, right? Texted with my father today, got information, texted back, learned something new about him, strengthened our relationship. So gratitude could be about a huge thing, right? You're elected student body president, you know, you get a 4-point average on your grades, but it can just be, you know, an everyday modest, humble kind of thing, right? A good meal, a good conversation with a friend, you know, beautiful weather, beautiful walk, whatever it was, something that can be not, again, in the newspaper, but something that for you is something you're grateful for. What they found is that 90% of people who are moderately depressed, I'm not talking severe depression like you're about to jump off a bridge, but moderately depressed, indicated that doing this increased their happiness significantly. Now, why? Well, the reason that this works is that when we are looking for something, we're more likely to find it. If I were to give you $100 for everyone you saw that was wearing blue shoes, and I really did that, at the end of the day, you would have noticed a lot more blue shoes than you normally noticed, right? Why? Not because more blue shoes popped into existence, but because you noticed them. You were on the lookout for them, right? You'd be looking around at people's shoes. Oh, is that blue shoes? And therefore, you'd find more blue shoes. So our lives are obviously a combination of things that are enjoyable and positive and good and things that are not so good. But our default can be so easily to look at just what's negative and bad and not the way we want it. Right? And there's good reason for that. If you think about ourselves in terms of our evolutionary past, if we didn't see the lion behind the bush, well, we'd get eaten and die. So we have to be alert in our evolutionary past to what's negative, what's a big threat. If we miss seeing a nice apple that we could have eaten, well, it's not the end of the world. Right? So we're kind of inclined to notice, to focus on whatever is negative. So when I read this finding, I thought, wow, that's interesting. I've heard about this idea of gratitude before. You know, in the Catholic tradition. Is this part of our tradition at all? It's actually a huge part of our tradition. Right? Think about what the Eucharist is. I don't know if any of you know Greek. But the word Eucharist means thanksgiving. Every Mass is an occasion of giving thanks to God. Right? What are the last words of every Mass? Thanks be to God. Those are the last words as we go out the door. And they did an interesting study about suicide, and they found that in the United States, the number of people committing suicide gets to its very lowest in the year on Thanksgiving Day. And we Catholics are really lucky because we don't have Thanksgiving Day just once a year. We have it every Sunday. We can have it even more often. Every Mass is a chance for Thanksgiving. So I noticed, well, this is really interesting, kind of overlap between what the church teaches and what actually leads to, even on a purely psychological account, greater happiness. And then when I read about the evidence about altruistic activity, I thought, oh, that's interesting too. Because the church is proposed from the very beginning, serving your neighbor, loving your neighbor, doing the corporal works of mercy, the spiritual works of mercy. Here's another overlap that I found very fascinating. There's a secular psychologist named Christopher Peterson, who was one of the foremost scholars in positive psychology. And he said that forgiveness is the queen of the virtues. Again, this is secular psychology. Forgiveness is the queen of the virtues. Why? Well, if it's true that good relationships are the very heart of happiness, the key thing, then forgiveness has to be also a key thing. Why? Because without forgiveness, there can be no long-term good, loving relationships. I mean, just think about your own family. Has your mom or your dad or your brother or your sister ever done something that made you mad? Raise your hand. Yeah, everybody. So what happens if you don't have forgiveness? You tell your mom, we're done. It's over. I'm blocking you on the phone. I'm not talking to you. No Thanksgiving, no Christmas. Forget it. See you later. Dad, I'm done with you. Brother, I'm done with you. Sister, I'm done with you. Right? And I hope you have good friends. But if you have a long-term friendship with someone, is that person going to do something at some point that gets on your nerves, steps on your feet, or hurts you, offends you, whatever? For sure. Right? If you get married, you don't think your husband or wife's going to do something at some point that drives you crazy and you're like, I can't believe this, I'm so mad, I'm so upset? For sure. So you just get divorced and marry somebody new. But you don't think your new spouse is going to do something that makes you mad, upset, steps on your feet, hurts your feelings? If you're married more than a year, for sure they are. So if you don't have forgiveness, what happens is you have no long-term relationships at all with anybody. No family, no friends, no spouse, nothing. Well, is that going to harm you? Yeah, I mean, if it's true that good relationships are the heart of happiness, yeah, of course, it's going to undermine your happiness. So forgiveness is absolutely key, according to the secular positive psychologists. You guys ever heard of the importance of happiness from any other source, maybe? Anybody else talked about happiness, you know? You guys ever heard of a guy, Jesus of Nazareth? What did Jesus have to say about happiness, or about forgiveness? Well, when his disciples said, Lord, teach us how to pray, he gave them the Our Father. Right in the middle of the Our Father, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Did any of you hear the gospel today? Pray for those who persecute you. Pray for your enemies. Do good for those who do evil to you. When Jesus was dying on the cross, one of the last things he said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. So Jesus emphasized over and over in what he said and what he did, the key importance of forgiveness. So we have service, we have gratitude, we have forgiveness. What is positive psychology doing? Well, positive psychology is giving us an empirical justification for many of the key practices in our own faith tradition. You have, in other words, faith and reason working together, not opposed. Faith and reason in harmony. You have reasonable faith and faithful reason. Key idea. So you might say, if positive psychology is so great, what would I need Christianity for? Maybe all I need is positive psychology. I'll go with Martin Seligman. I'll do some service. I'll forgive other people. I'll do some gratitude, and I'm all set. I don't need God. I don't need Jesus. I don't need sacraments. I don't need the church. Well, I don't think that's going to work either. There are some things that positive psychology cannot give us, as good as positive psychology is. It is not enough. So what's lacking? Well, one thing that's lacking is any level for happiness. Any happiness as it's related to the divine. Because in positive psychology, it is neutral with respect to God's existence. It's a purely empirical science. And God is not an empirical thing. God's not a material object in the world that we can weigh, that we can measure, that we can say, God is beyond that. And yet, the human heart naturally desires to know the truth. But no merely material thing can satisfy that desire. The human heart wants to have perfect goodness. But no human person can satisfy that desire we have for perfect goodness. And the human heart wants perfect love. But no human relationship can ever give that to us either. And finally, we want perfect life. But our human life is always limited, right? We live 80 years, maybe 90 years, but at some point it comes to an end. So we want perfect life, we want perfect love, we want perfect truth, we want perfect goodness, but we can never find that here. And so if we're going to have perfect happiness, it has to be with the one who is perfect life, perfect truth, perfect goodness, perfect love. And no human person can ever deliver that for us. Psychology also is really good with helping us to have more positive emotion. But what psychology can never do is forgive the negative emotion of guilt. Well, it can take away the feeling of guilt, but it can't take away the reality of guilt. So what's the difference? Think about a super bad cavity, a really corrupt tooth. Novocaine can take away the feeling of pain in your tooth so that you get a shot of Novocaine, all of a sudden your tooth doesn't ache anymore. That's something. But it doesn't get rid of the actual infection and the corruption of the tooth. And so if you don't treat that, what happens? Well, the infection in your tooth can spread to your brain. And if it spreads to your brain, well, that kills you. So what we need in the moral life is not just an anesthetization of our negative feelings of guilt. We need something that takes away our guilt. But positive psychology cannot take away our guilt. But that's exactly an aspect of Christianity that Jesus did come to give us. All of us know that we fail to hit the mark. All of us, to a greater or lesser degree, do things that we know, oh, geez, I shouldn't have done that. And if all we had is merely an anesthetization of our guilt, a feeling, taking away the feeling of guilt, that would be enough. We want something that actually makes us no longer guilty, a forgiveness of our sins. And that's why we're so lucky as Catholics, incredibly lucky. Because you know what? Whether you're an atheist, a Catholic, a Jew, whatever, everyone feels guilty about things they do. There's no one to walk around, if they're honest at least, who thinks, I'm perfect. I've never sinned. I've never hurt anyone's feelings. I'm just gliding along, total perfection. And so what happens is we all make garbage. And most people carry around their garbage for months, years, even decades. All the garbage they've made in their life. But we have a way of throwing out the garbage. Right? That's what every confession is. If you're carrying around a bunch of garbage, use banana peel, whatever, you get rid of it, you throw it all away. That's what the work of Jesus does for us. Positive psychology cannot give us that. And positive psychology also cannot give us any answer to death. Because if you think about it, death destroys all these things, right? No positive emotion anymore, no engagement at all. You're dead, it's hard to have a relationship with anyone, no meaning anymore, and no achievement anymore. And positive psychology just has no answer for the problem of death. But again, Christian faith does, right? We have the hope of the resurrection. We have the hope of eternal life. Positive psychology can't provide that. So, when we think about the goods that positive psychology can give us, there are legitimate goods, but there's also a lot that it can't give, right? That Christianity does give. Now, if you put all this together, you might say, look, if you're right, why aren't Christians, all Christians, super happy? Anyone here ever met a grumpy Christian? Oh, looks like most people have. You never met a grumpy Christian your whole life?
I have been a grumpy Christian. Well, you
never met a grumpy Christian. All right. So how do you explain that? If everything I've said is correct, how do you explain the fact, and I think it is a fact, that there are some Christians who, it seems, are very unhappy? I think you can explain the fact. So here's a part of the explanation. Part of the explanation is genetic. If you think about us in terms of physical health, you've probably noticed that there are some people that you know who are always sick, always going to the doctor, half the time they're in bed, always sniffling, always health problems. And you probably know other people that are almost never sick, never go to the doctor, never seem to get a cold, never seem to get a flu, always seem really robust, right? Think about people in terms of their athletic ability. You probably know some people that are terrible at sports, right? Can't make a free throw to save their lives. Other people are just 95% free throw shooters. Everything's, they're just great, right? We differ in terms of also our genetic set point in terms of happiness. So what do I mean by that? If you look at little kids, some little kids, you'll see, are just naturally kind of upbeat, naturally cheerful, naturally kind of springing their step. Other little kids are more downtrodden, brown. Things are, they're just, that's just the way they are. So there's a diversity in the human family in terms of all kinds of things, right? Sickness and health, being upbeat, being cheerful, not being upbeat, not being cheerful. And so you could have someone who's a Christian, and yet just because of their genetic endowment, they just happen to have a kind of downcast, less cheerful, less optimistic genetic set point for happiness. Right? And if they're a Christian, they're going to be more happy than they otherwise would be. And yet they might be less happy than somebody else because of their genetic set point. A second thing that explains that they're unhappy Christians. In the United States, some people go to the doctor with, you know, a problem, asthma, whatever it is, you know, skin problems, and the doctor gives them a prescription, and they go home, and they don't take their own medication. In fact, there's a lot of people who are more faithful in giving their pets medication than they are in giving themselves medication, right? Now, if you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, hey, you've got this asthma problem, take Cerevit. Do this every morning. This is going to help you. And you just don't do it. Well, is your asthma going to get better? No. Right? The same thing is true of Christ the physician. Christ gives us prescriptions. He says, hey, you've got some enemies, people that you just hate. Why don't you pray for them? Why don't you do good for them? And you're like, God, that's great advice, Jesus. Thanks very much. I really appreciate that. And you go home and you don't do it. Right? The church asks us to be grateful. Oh, that's great advice. I love that. It's idea of gratitude is super. But then you never do it. Well, what good is it going to do? The church tells us to do, especially during the season of Lent, acts of what? Prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. Church keeps on urging us, hey, this Lent, time to do this. Right? What is almsgiving? It's not limited simply to giving money to charity. That's one way to give alms. But almsgiving has to do with some kind of help for those in need. Right? An act of mercy. You guys heard of the corporal works of mercy and the spiritual works of mercy? Those are all almsgiving in a broad sense. So the church asks us to do this, especially in the season of Lent. Right? But some people do it, some people don't. The church asks us, Jesus asks us, to refrain from doing evil. Why? Well, if we do evil to others, how is our relationship with others going to be? It's going to be bad. Right? If we think about the levels of happiness that I just talked about earlier, the levels of happiness 3 and 4 have to do with what? With loving your neighbor. But when we do evil to others, that's the opposite of willing their good. When we kill other people, when we bear false witness against other people, when we steal from other people, all those are ways of undermining, not serving and helping other people, but harming other people. Again, the opposite of loving. So one reason Christians are less happy than they would be is that rather than take the doctor's advice, they don't take the doctor's advice. Right? They don't do good and avoid evil. Right? They do evil and avoid doing good. So of course they're less happy than they would be. How healthy will you be if you go to the doctor and don't take any of the medication that the doctor gives you? So these are 2 reasons. Now if we think about why people do wrong and why people fail to do right, Aquinas talks about 3 causes of sin. So the causes of sin according to Aquinas are malice, ignorance, and weakness of will. So what is malice? Malice is where you're like, I don't care, God. I'm doing what I want. I hate you. I hate other people. And I'm just going to be Satan, number 2. Do whatever evil thing I want. ignorance is, oh, I had no idea that driving drunk was wrong. I had no idea that this or that was wrong. And it's a situation where you could have known it was wrong and you should have known it was wrong, but you didn't investigate that properly and so did evil out of ignorance. And the third is weakness of will. And weakness of will is where you know the right thing to do, part of you wants to do the right thing, and then you get in the situation and, oh my gosh, before you know it, you're doing the wrong thing. So talk to your neighbor for a second. Which of these three causes of sin do you think is most common for most people? Is it that they're just pure malice? They just like, I don't care, I'm doing evil and I just want to do it? Is it that they're ignorant? That they just didn't know that this was evil and they could have known and should have known but just didn't? Or is it the third, weakness of will, where they know what's right and wrong really at some level and then they get in the moment and one thing leads to another and oh shoot, now I'm doing the wrong thing. So Dr. Neighbor, what do you think is the most common of this three?
Why do people make bad decisions?
All right, so what did you guys come up with? What is, in your opinion, of these three causes of sin that Aquinas talks about? What would you say, like in the background, what would you say? Weakness of will, malice, ignorance?
Weakness of will, but we're debating whether the close second is ignorance or malice.
Okay, so you think weakness of will is the most common?
Yes.
Okay, how about you? What did you come up with in your group?
We were a bit, like, torn between the two, but...
Which two?
She said...
Weakness of will.
And I said that it might be malice.
Malice. Okay. Interesting. How about you in the front? What do you think?
We're split. I think we have different answers too.
Yeah. You had. You were thinking.
I was between ignorance and weakness of will as like the top two.
Mm-hmm.
And malice on top.
Interesting. Malice on top. Okay. Well, there's two people or three people in this room who have extensive experience talking to people with problems, and so I'm guessing. Since they've talked to probably hundreds, if not thousands of people about their difficulties and failures, I'm guessing they may have the light to share. Maybe, maybe not. What do you, fathers, what would you say?
Yeah, weakness of will is the one that comes just like strongly, forcefully to mind.
It does. Weakness of will comes to mind. Yeah.
It's huge.
And I would guess maybe in the world there might be different answers, but I would bet honestly $1,000 that in this room, there's almost no one who sins out of malice. Just like, I don't care about you, God. I'm just going to sock it to you and hell with you. I'm guessing no one in this room has that. And I'm guessing very few in this room also have ignorance, that they do wrong things. And like, you're telling me drunk driving's wrong? Really? God, well, I'm glad to know. Okay. Yeah, I'm glad I had no idea that was wrong. But thanks for informing me. Yeah, okay. I'm not supposed to punch my wife in the face? Really? Oh, okay. I'm glad to know. I'm guessing probably for most people in this room, this is not, you know, news to them, right? You know what's right and wrong, generally. Could there be some arcane things you don't? Okay, fine. But in general, most people understand the basics of right and wrong. So that leaves weakness of will. So here, what I want to do to conclude my talk is talk about some of the psychological evidence that helps us to deal with weakness of will. Because I'm guessing for most people in this room and most people in the world, actually, I would say the biggest cause of sin for them isn't ignorance, that they had no idea this was wrong, and also is not malice. There are some people that are really malicious, you know, serial killers, okay. But I'm probably, hopefully, none of you are serial killers. So I think it's really weakness of will that's a key problem. So what can you do for weakness of will? There's been a lot of research about willpower, how to strengthen it. And you can think of these things as the various natural means that God can give us to help us to achieve our goals, our end. So one of the things that they found in the literature on willpower is that willpower is a little bit like a muscle. Now, if you know from working out, maybe some of you hit the weights. If you hit the weights and you keep on working out and you keep on lifting, over time, right, if you've got good technique and whatever, you're going to get way stronger, right? Because a muscle is something that if you work it out, you get stronger. If you're a runner, the more you run, right, the more you're going to improve in terms of running. So how do we strengthen willpower? Well, we can strengthen willpower by acts of self-denial. And in the Catholic tradition, this is called mortification. The idea is doing something that you would prefer not to do. So what would that mean? Well, here are some ideas. Every time you eat a meal, it is an opportunity for you to practice some self-denial. Right? Why? Well, because maybe you like to put butter on your bread. Well, you can put less butter on your bread than you otherwise would. Maybe you like to put salt on your food. Well, you could decide not to put salt on your food. Maybe you really love steak and you really don't like vegetables. Well, maybe you can eat the vegetables first and leave the steak till later. Right? The idea of self-denial is that you would like to do this, and yet you're going to choose not to do this. And we're right now in a whole season of self-denial called Lent. Right? Lent comes from the word meaning to grow. Right? And we grow stronger in terms of our muscles when we exercise them, when we have some resistance, lift some weights. We grow stronger in terms of our willpower by acts of self-denial, acts of mortification. This is not about hating yourself. It's not about hating your body. It's about growing and helping strengthening yourself. And it is helpful often to talk to someone who has experience in the spiritual life, because some people can go excessive in terms of self-denial and be like, oh, self-denial, that's great. Okay, so for Lent, I'll only eat bread and water on Fridays and not eat anything the rest of the Lent. Okay, well, that is also, that's a problem, right? So I'm not talking about doing crazy stuff and sitting on top of a post for, you know, 20 years straight. I'm talking about everyday normal things that are not going to harm you in any way, like not putting butter on your bread, like not putting sugar in your coffee, right? Like not speaking and not swearing, not using curse words. That involves a kind of exercise, because you might be inclined to let off a couple F-bombs, but then you say, okay, I'm going to hold that back, right? So, like, here's another example of self-denial. You set the alarm in the morning, get up at 7:30 or whatever, and when the alarm goes off, you get out of bed. That's some self-denial, because you would prefer to do what? To be in a nice, cozy, warm bed and just sit there. But you can deny yourself and get out of bed, right? So self-denial is a way to build willpower, again, according to the secular psychologists, right? Who, as you may have gathered the theme of this talk, seem to reinvent the wheel of things that we've known in the Catholic tradition for centuries. Here's another thing you can do. It's called surfing the urge. Let's say your weakness of will object is alcohol, right? And so you gave up alcohol for Lent, let's say, and here it comes, you know, Friday night, and you're like, oh my gosh, I really want to have a beer. Jeez, this is really, this is hard for me. And I gave up alcohol for Lent, all my friends are out having a beer, and I want to get a beer. What can you do in a situation like that? Well, what the psychologists recommend is thinking about urge to do something that you know you shouldn't do, a little bit like you think as you might treat a bear that comes into your campground. So you guys ever done any camping? Anyone here done camping? Okay, so there's a protocol if a bear enters your campground. And rule number one is don't feed the bear, right? Now, why do you not want to feed the bear? What happens if you're in a campground and you feed the bear? What happens, yeah?
It's that if we feed the bear, inclined to remain hotter.
Yeah. If you feed the bear probably is going to stick around. The bear actually may go get bear cousins and friends and sisters. Now you got five bears in the campground, right? And you say, well, just feed those. Well, if you feed the five bears, now you're going to have the whole bear clan showing up. You're going to have 20 bears in the campground before you know it. So feeding the bear is not going to work. And likewise, feeding an urge doesn't work. If you have an urge to drink alcohol, you're like, oh, I just better just drink some alcohol to get over this. Right? The more you drink, the more it's going to be hard to resist the urge to drink alcohol. So feeding the bear is not going to help. What about fighting the bear? Yeah, get out there with a baseball bat. Fight the bear. Is that going to work, do you think? No? Why don't you hit the bear right over the head with a baseball bat? That'd be a great idea. No, not a great idea. Why? Because one of the things that is very hard to control are your thoughts. So let's do a little experiment right now. I want you guys to think about anything you want to think about except for pink elephants. Think about anything you want other than pink elephants. Go ahead. I'll just give you a few minutes to do that. Anyone think about pink elephants? If you're trying not to think about pink elephants, guess what happens? You start thinking about pink elephants. Right? So to say, don't think about pink elephants, don't think about it out here. All you're going to think about is pink elephants. Right? It's called ironic rebound effect in psychology. Telling someone not to think about pink elephants makes them think about pink elephants. So, what do you do if the bear wanders into your campground? Well, you don't fight the bear. You don't say, I'm not going to think about pink elephants. You also don't feed the bear, because that leads to even more bears showing up and things getting worse and worse. But what do? You surf the urge. You ignore the bear that wandered in your campground. Now, why does this work? Well, this works for a very simple reason. The nature of the human mind is to be restless. And you all know this from your own experience. Think about, I'm sure this has happened to you. You have a math test coming up. And you say, okay, I got the big math test coming up tomorrow. I'm going to study today. So you get out the books. You say, I'm ready to study. 3 o'clock. I'm going to study from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And you sit down and study. And what happens? Do you sit down there for 3 hours and nonstop math the whole time? Is that how it goes? Or, in fact, do you sit down and study math and then you're like, oh, I should check my phone. Oh, I'm kind of hungry. Oh, I should maybe go to the bathroom. Oh, there's my friend over there. I should maybe visit my friend. And all of a sudden, you're thinking about all kinds of stuff other than math. Now, maybe if you're a good student, you go back and say, no, I got to study math, and you go back. But the fact is, even if you're trying to focus on one thing, your mind just naturally wanders away over time. This happens in praying, too. You ever sat down and be like, I'm going to worship the Lord. I'm going to do Eucharistic adoration. I'm going to pray. I'm going to really focus on God. And then pretty soon you're like, oh, I wonder what's for dinner tonight. Oh, I'm kind of hungry. Oh, that's an interesting sweatshirt. What is this person's sweatshirt? Oh, yeah, I wonder what my mom thinks. And all of a sudden you're just thinking about all kinds of stuff, right? The human mind of its very nature can't, even if you try, focus just on one thing for, 5 hours straight. Now, this is bad news when you're studying for a test, because you can't study for 5 hours straight for a test. And it's bad news if you're trying to focus on God and pray, because even if you try to focus on God and pray, pretty soon you're going to be thinking about lunch and, someone's sweatshirt and whatever. But it's good news when you're tempted. Whenever you're tempted, know for an absolute fact, this is not going to last forever. In fact, most temptations last only about 10, 15 minutes. They really do. So think about like a bear wandering on the campground. The bear's going to sniff around. The bear's going to look for some food. The bear's going to do whatever. But if there's no food that's given to the bear's going to get bored. The bear's going to just take off. And the same thing's true of temptation. So when you feel tempted, it can feel like, well, the only way to get rid of this is to give in. I better just get that beer out of the fridge and start drinking it. That's not true. The temptation will go away. Again, just naturally, human mind can't just stay on one topic for, a long, super long time. And most of the time, it goes in about 15 minutes. The last thing that I would recommend in terms of strengthening willpower is not to put yourself in a situation where you have to exercise willpower. So if you go back to the drinking example, if you are trying to give up drinking for Lent, do not put a whole bunch of six packs of booze in your beer in your fridge. That is a super bad idea. Don't go to the bar if you gave up drinking for Lent and everyone's drinking around you and say, hey, can I buy you a drink? This is putting yourself in a situation to make yourself at a huge disadvantage. What you can do is put up as many obstacles to drinking, let's say, as you can, right? Now, even if you do all these things, given human nature, the probability is that at some point, in some ways, you're going to have weakness of will, right? You're going to fail. And if that happens, which it most likely will happen, the key thing here is to try to learn from what happened, right? Like, let's go back to the drinking example. Oh, you know, I gave up drinking for Lent, and then I went out with Stacy, and, you know, we were at this party, and oh my gosh, now I drank, and my Lent resolution got broken, right? So, if that happens, you try to learn, okay, well, what happened there? I went out with Stacy, and every time I go out with Stacy, every time I go out with Kevin, we end up drinking. And you think, okay, he's my friend, she's my friend, I want to be friends with her, but I also want to avoid drinking. So maybe what I'll do is invite Kevin, invite Stacy, whoever, and say, hey, let's go for a hike on Sunday. Because if we go out for a hike on Sunday afternoon, well, there's no bars along the, you know, up in the trail where we're hiking. So I'll have a fun friendship with the person, and I'll avoid the situation where I'm going to be around a bunch of people drinking and more likely to break my Lent resolution. So in other words, use the failure as an opportunity to move in a better direction. Right, to say, okay, well, that didn't work, so I'm going to try this other method, right? So take a failure as an occasion for learning something important about how to grow from the failure, right? And we as Catholics, again, are very lucky, because when we have willpower failures, we don't have to sit there and wallow in it and say, oh, gosh, I'm just, you know, everything's ruined. That is one of the reasons God gave us the sacrament of confession, right, to start over. Right, to start over. So, perfect willpower is not going to be possible in this life. We're not going to ever be in a situation where we're the Blessed Virgin Mary and we're just flawless and everything is always perfect and we're just loving God perfectly, loving our neighbor perfectly, everything's great. But what is certainly possible is improvement. Right? Getting better. Right? So I'll give an example from my own life. When I was younger, I used to drink too much. Now, I've never been arrested for drunk driving, and I never went to AA, but I would, when I go out with friends, drink too much. And for years, I sort of struggled with this. And I thought, oh, gosh, you know, I shouldn't drink so much, and this was too bad. And I remember going to confession one time to a priest. This was before I graduated from high school. And I asked the priest, is getting drunk a mortal sin? And the priest said, yes. Now, this was not the answer I was hoping he'd give. So then I had a follow-up question. I said, well, how much can I drink before it becomes a mortal sin? And he said, you can drink as much as you want, so long as it's compatible with loving God with your whole heart and loving your neighbor as yourself. So I thought about that for a long time, for really decades. I thought, well, how much is that? And I didn't want to know the answer. But really, after a long time, really decades, I came to an answer that works for me. And for me, the answer is zero. Zero beers, zero alcohol. And I'm not telling you what to do. It's your life, it's your body, it's your relationship with God. But that's what I think God wanted me to do. So that's what I've done for the last year and a half. And what I found is that this actually improved my willpower in other areas of life. This is, as it were, a constant mortification that moves me more towards who I want to be. So again, I'm not telling you what to do. This is your life, it's your choice, and God may call you to do something different, but that's what God called me to. So willpower can improve, and I'm not putting myself before you like some perfect saint. I'm not at all, but I am better than before. And that's something worth striving for. All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.